Welcome to the Internal Comms Podcast with me, Casey McCauley. This is a show devoted to informing, energising and generally inspiring those of us responsible for communication inside our organisations. Every fortnight, my aim is to bring you insights, strategies and success stories from influential thinkers in our field, comms practitioners, authors, academics and consultants. This episode hinges on a very specific and interesting question. What do people say about you when you're not in the room? That's how my guest today defines our personal brand or professional reputation. And he should know, because he is the personal brand expert, Chris Ducker. Now, I've long wanted to interview Chris for some time because I believe we live in an age when I think we all need to think about our professional reputations, whether we're an employee working in-house, for an agency, or as an independent consultant. The right reputation helps us unlock new opportunities, connects us with like-minded people, and positions us for work that really matters to us, that aligns with our talents and interests. Several friends in internal comms have mentioned the transformative impact of Chris's coaching and mentoring sessions. And it's obvious why. He really does walk the talk. He's a serial entrepreneur, best-selling author, and a very successful keynote speaker. He's the author of Virtual Freedom and, more recently, Rise of the Youpreneur, the definitive guide to becoming the go-to leader in your industry and building a future-proof business. Now, I want to stress, I think the advice and insight that Chris shares in this conversation is relevant if you are an employee or if you're an independent consultant. We talk about the importance of identifying your unique point of difference, how to create a social media presence not solely built on what Chris calls rented land, and how to craft the right kind of content for your particular audience. And we get personal too. We talk about burnout, legacy, and the importance of realizing we are not, after all, invincible. So without further ado, I bring you what I hope you'll find is a very thought-provoking conversation with Chris Ducker. So, Chris, welcome to the Internal Comms Podcast. It's a pleasure to have you here.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm going to start in a slightly strange place, if that's okay. If I've done okay.
Rather ominous sounding.
It's ominous already. If my research is correct, there is a backstory, Chris, and there's a pun intended here. I think we both have shared a common experience around some pretty evasive spinal surgery. I'm just wondering, am I barking up the right tree? Did that experience in any way shape, influence your thinking professionally in particular?
I think it's had a bit of a knock-on effect across the board, really, more than anything else. Not just business, but also life stuff too. The back surgery came about, it was the tail end of a burnout for me. I burnt out at the very end of 2009 and then recovered from that in 2010, hired a whole bunch of people, all that good stuff. But what had happened was, in the run-up to that burnout, I'd been sat on a chair 14 hours a day, crushing my lower spine, and ultimately had disc problems. And then one day, my son decided to jump on me like Superman, and that was that. And so it was kind of like, you know, if you've gone through it, you know how painful it is, you know how debilitating it can be. I was young enough to hopefully go through that surgery at the time. We're talking about maybe 12 years or so ago, and recover relatively quickly from it. So I decided to go ahead and have the surgery. I'm glad I did because it fixed the problem. I haven't had any problems since. And if anything, it catapulted me into the mindset of, holy crap, I'm not unstoppable. I'm not unbreakable. Mm. And if I want to play a longer game in business and life, then I need to start looking after myself properly. That was really the catalyst for me to start getting more serious about my health, my diet, my sleep. And I don't do the whole biohacking thing or anything like that, but like supplementation and understanding the importance of having a proper physical every year, scans every year, hiring a nutritionist to clean up my diet, my gut, all these things that you really don't think all that much about. But then once you start running blood tests and whatnot, you're like, okay, I'm actually not in great shape. There's a lot I can be doing here. If I want to act and lead in a way that is ambitious for myself, but also inspiring for other people who decide to follow my work, then I need to lead by example. And that's what I've done. Not to mention the fact, obviously, that I've got four kids and, you know, they need to see me doing the right things to be around long-term for them as well. So it's drastically changed everything in terms of the way that I work and keep my energy levels high, but also from personal perspective. If you'd have asked me 15 years ago if I'd be doing yoga three times a week, I would have called you mad. But here I am on the mat three times a week. So there you go.
Are you seeing more burnout, do you think, amongst the people that you train and coach?
Yes.
You are.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's scary, quite frankly. I've certainly seen a lot more of it over the pandemic period. I've always said that burnout is inevitable for an entrepreneur. It's not a matter of if, it's just a matter of when.
Right.
Unless they get smart about the way that they look after themselves and run their business. So that's everything from delegating a certain amount to staying in your zone of genius and not trying to be the jack of all trades and all that sort of stuff. But I've seen a lot more of it over the last 4 or 5 years or so. And I think the pandemic was good and bad in that regards. It was good because it showed us actually life is pretty short. I don't know about you, but I lost a couple of people to COVID in the early days. And, you know, it taught us that life is short and that there's a heck of a lot that we have zero control over.
Yeah.
But equally, it showed us that we do have a certain amount of control over everything that we do day to day as well. And leaders in general, even if you're not running a business, if you are in a position of leadership, that kind of hustle culture has taught us to chase it down and to go for the easy money and all these kind of things. And that's a problem. But yes, I've seen more of it and I'm still seeing it and it's scary.
You are famous. You're most famous for personal branding, helping people discover who they really are and present that to the world.
Yes.
I thought we should start with a definition, though. What is a personal brand? How do you define it?
At the core of it, it's your reputation. That's basically what a personal brand is. So you don't need to be an entrepreneur to build a personal brand or to understand the power of a personal brand. Anybody that wants to do well in their career has got a personal brand. It's your reputation. But I like to sum it up in one sentence, and that is your personal brand is what people say about you when you're not around, because that gets people thinking a little bit deeper about it. So if you're not at that conference or at that dinner party or at that coffee meeting and your name pops up in conversation, what is it you're known for? What is it that people are saying about you? And that's your personal brand. So it's kind of important.
Yes.
You know, it's about as important as it comes, I think.
Yes. And I just want to hone in on that because I think we're going to have listeners who are probably independent consultants in the comms space, but we're also going to have a lot of listeners who are in-house comms practitioners. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing, as you say, a lot of this applies if you just want a good professional reputation.
Totally. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, in terms of strategies of building a personal brand, monetizing a personal brand, et cetera, there's certain things that would not apply to somebody who is an internal employee in a business, but still wants to build a strong personal brand and reputation within A, that company, and B, the industry as a wider net. But also there's certain things, obviously, if you do want to be more entrepreneurial about things, if you're a consultant or a freelancer or a speaker or an author, there are definitely strategies that you can build up and act upon that will help you monetize the expertise that you've got a lot better. Ultimately, I'd say pretty much about 75% of what I teach and what I advocate is good for everyone. The other 25% is only relevant for those that are really out on their own and want to build that six, seven-figure business based around what it is that they do and what they're known for. And I think a lot of people say, wait a minute, did you just say multi six and seven figures, like as an expert? Oh, yeah, definitely I just said that. There are a lot of personal brand entrepreneurs out there with very small teams, no more than three or four people working for them, that are doing £500,000, £250,000, $1 million plus based around their expertise. But you look at anybody who's got a decent book, a decent speaking career, a decent coaching or consulting career, they all have the ability to do that kind of money should they want to. And one of my clients just recently, at the beginning of this year, we were at a retreat for our roundtable mastermind. And this particular person had been a member of my group for about 4 years. And she's grown and grown and grown and grown. And she's plateaued at around about the 600,000 turnover mark over the last couple of years. And I said to her, how do you feel about this? And she said to me, actually, I feel very good about this. I don't feel like I need to go any further in terms of revenue, but where I do want to grow is internally and with the impact that I have in the people that I'm serving. Right. So she has realized, actually, she's okay doing $500,000, $600K a year. She doesn't have any aspirations to grow that any further, but she wants to do deeper work with the people that are hiring her. And that's a really strong person that's got that kind of self-awareness. That's gold.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's worth £1 million right there. That self-awareness, right?
I would also think she's going to earn more over the long term just because she's going to be able to sustain that level of revenue rather than, as you say, burn yourself out doing something.
Absolutely. And to the point, when the team is lean and mean like that as well, her margins are 65-75%. Who do you know that's getting 65-75% on $500,000 a year? That's a big profit margin.
So for anyone who's listening to this thinking, gosh, I need one of these. I need one of these personal brands, whether they're in-house, whether they're thinking one day I'd like to throw myself into the outside world and be an independent practitioner and really be attractive to a certain set of clients. I don't want you to give all your secrets away, but give me an idea of where I start. How do I begin this journey of building a personal brand?
I think the really big question that a lot of people skip over here when at the beginning of their journey is they think about what they know and who they can help. And they attach those two things together and they think that's what my personal brand is going to be. But actually, I think you need to reverse engineer it a little bit. And you need to think about 3-5 years down the line, what is it that I am known for in my industry? What is it that I am known for? And actually, you probably already know what it is that you can be known for. It is what people come to you for answers on, for help on a consistent basis already. So if you look back at the whole, hey, Katie, can I pick your brains moments? If you go back on those for the last 12 to 18 months and all the coffee conversations you've had and the quick Zoom catch-ups and the FaceTimes and the texts and all the rest of it, if you look at all the discussions you've had, there's a very big probability that three or four things in terms of themes or topics or subjects pop up quite regularly.
Yes.
That's what your personal brand is ultimately going to become. Right there. It's how you can affect the most change and provide the most solutions to people's problems in terms of stitching those two things together. So I think a lot of people overthink it. If you look at where you want to be 3 years from now and then reverse engineer it back, the answer will probably smack you around the face pretty heavily. And the beautiful thing with a personal brand is, and I often say this, it's the last pivot career-wise that you'll ever make, because what happens is, when you're known for one specific thing or a set of things, ultimately over a period of time, and it doesn't take very long, just a couple of years most of the time, you become known for that thing and you become somebody's favorite when it comes to that thing. And that's what we should all be aiming to do as personal brands. We should be aiming to become somebody's favorite. So somebody's favorite director, somebody's favorite leader, somebody's favorite operations manager, somebody's favorite podcaster or live streamer or email newsletter host, whatever it is, if you become somebody's favorite, that then swings open doors of opportunities. But more importantly here, as your own interests morph and change over the period of time because you're somebody's favorite and they're following you because of you first and foremost, and then what it is that you talk about secondly, they will more likely stick with you as you pivot and change your focus a little bit in the future. So if you think about it, it's not like a regular business where you set up a brand-based business, you build it up, and then if you want to change, holy moly, now I've got to start from scratch all over again. New promises, new clients, new options, new marketing, et cetera, et cetera. But if you are at the very core of everything that you do, it's a lot easier to be able to pivot and change based on your own interests.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Yeah. All of that said, if I open up, say, for example, LinkedIn these days, it seems quite a crowded marketplace in terms of individuals selling their expertise, their knowledge, etc. It would appear that content is key here, would I be right, in kind of really getting sticky with that personal brand and bringing people to you? How important is content in the mix of all this in establishing your
content,
brand?
Content has always been important, right? Let's not lose track of that fact. It's always been important, particularly when we talk about building a personal brand online. I got active, even though I've been building businesses and websites since the mid-90s, but I really got active online in 2008 when I started a blog. And then I started podcasting in 2010. And then I got a book deal in 2012. The book came out 2014, and it's just snowballed from there. But content's always been important. What's changed a lot over the years, though, is that how we create and publish that content has changed a lot. And more importantly, how we consume that content has changed a lot as well. 10 years ago, it was all about blogging and podcasting. Now you never hear people talking about blogging. Podcasting, yes, but blogging has basically fallen by the wayside. What's happened over the last 7, 8, 9 years or so has been this huge boom of social media content. And now, and this is both good and really, 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 really bad, right? I hope I accentuated the word really enough there. Because I feel quite opinionated about this. What is good about social media is the fact that we can utilize all these platforms like LinkedIn and Instagram and Facebook and TikTok and everything else that's out there. We can utilize these platforms to be able to spread our message and to attract ultimately new audience and community members into our ecosystems. That's great. Can't take anything away from that fact. But what's really bad about this is that A, man, it's noisy out there.
It's noisy.
Right? Everybody's doing it, right? First and foremost. And secondly, what's really bad about it is that you don't own any of those platforms. So what you're ultimately doing, if you rely on LinkedIn, if you rely on YouTube, if you rely on Instagram to build that following, you are building your home on rented land.
Yes.
Fact, right? And so that's a very dangerous situation to be in. And we've seen it before. People have huge Facebook groups and then no fault to themselves, but somebody in the group posts something that's against Facebook's T&Cs.
Right.
And the group gets shut down. And there goes your prospecting group right there. It's finished. People have got millions of hundreds of thousands of subscribers on YouTube.
Yes.
They do one thing and they get a copyright strike. It happens again and bosh, they've lost their YouTube channel, right? And I've seen it over and over again. Ad accounts on Facebook as well. You rely too much on just spending money to attract people into your ecosystem. And before you know what's happening, your ad account gets disabled. There's thousands of humans that work for Facebook, but you can't get hold of a single one of them, and your ad account gets shut down, and now you can't run ads and generate leads and get new business anymore. So it's a really bad problem as well. So I think what's going to happen here over the next 12 months, and I'm already starting to see this shift both in the work that I do as well as in my clients, more and more people are going to be utilizing live video again on social platforms. I think what's happened is there was a big boom a few years ago, and then everybody went to reels and to short form content, which has now just become completely flooded, right?
Right.
And super noisy. And so I think what's going to happen is people are going to spend less time planning content for social media like they do right now with all the editing and the graphics and everything else, and are going to be more raw about their content creation again. They're going to go live again with good old-fashioned bullet points on post-it notes and go live for 15 minutes talking about these four things or five things or whatever it is. And what's going to happen is then that's going to free up time from their day-to-day marketing activities that they can then focus on their email list more.
Right.
Because that's another issue that I've seen people do. They do what they need to do to get people on the list, create great opt-in offers, or, you know, spend a load of money on paid advertising to get people on their list. But then what happens is they don't nurture the list. They don't allow the people on their list to get to know them properly in order to be able to then go into a position of being able to make a buying decision at some point down the line. And so what's going to happen is less time on social. When you do go on social, it's going to be raw, unplugged, and somewhat personal and very unique because of that reason. And then because you've got all that extra time left over, I think email is going to become more and more important. This isn't just one man's opinion here. Like, I'm doing this myself, but also my clients are doing this and we're already starting to see results from it. And so that's my stance on it right now. Very long-winded answer, but I hope it was useful.
Really interesting, because I had recently an experience of doing a live Q&A on LinkedIn. And what I loved about it was that instant reaction from the audience. I got a sense of the questions they wanted to ask me and all the rest of it. So that's another wonderful thing about what you're describing, is that instant reaction from the audience.
You didn't need to spend any time.
No.
At all prepping for that call.
No.
Right? It's not like you spent 2-3 days working on a slide deck to do a webinar. It was raw. It was unplugged. It was personal. And you connected with everybody that was live. You made an actual genuine connection, a true touch point. And we need 6 or 7 of those before we're going to make a buying decision on average. So you did the right thing.
Yeah,
keep doing it.
It was fun. It was nerve-wracking, but fun. A quick word from our sponsor. AB is the world's most experienced internal comms agency. For 60 years, our brilliant consultants and fearless creatives have been helping organizations around the world inform, inspire, and enthuse their employees, building great organizations from the inside out. There is a lot of pressure on internal comms folks just now to help you plan, prioritize, and deliver astonishingly effective communications. Arrange a friendly, informal chat with us today. Simply email hello@abcom.co.uk. And if you do, I look forward to meeting you. But when it comes to what we are putting out into the world, and however it is we're putting that out, I think you have some rules around this content in terms of what it should be doing for the audience. Can you just share with us the strategy for this content?
So an overarching strategy is to have what I call a media company mindset.
Right.
Even if you're just a single person. And that's important because if you think about a media company, you are thinking about written word. You're thinking about visuals like graphics, infographics, carousel posts on social, pull quotes, stuff like that. You're also thinking about video, definitely thinking about video, and you're thinking about audio as well. So that mixed media approach to building up content based around your expertise, that's that, what I call that media company mindset, super important. But the general rule of thumb is that with every piece of content that you create, you need to educate, you need to inspire, and you need to entertain. You've got to do one of those three things in every piece of content that you create. If you can do all three, then you've created something very special every time, but you've got to do at least one of those three things on each piece of content that you create. And the reason why it's so important is every time you create a piece of content and you publish that on the internet, it becomes an instant business asset.
Right.
An instant personal brand asset. And unless it's like a story type post, say on Instagram, which disappears 24 hours later, it'll be around for a long time. If it is a blog post or an article of some variety, if it's a video or a podcast that's hosted on your site, whatever it is, that is an instant piece of content that is published immediately and will, for as long as it's up there, continue to bring in opportunities and leads and things like that right now. I can pull up the top 10 pages in terms of visitors on my website at chrisducker.com right now on Google Analytics. And I can probably say that about 50% of those top 10 pages are probably content that I wrote years ago.
Wow. Yeah.
Or published years ago, because they're still relevant. Everything I try and create is evergreen in my mind. From time to time, it'll be a little more kind of newsjacking approach or jumping on a trend or becoming more relevant in the time. But ultimately, I try and be as evergreen as I possibly can be because I want that asset to be around as long as possible.
I'm just saying, because I need to, that whoever's listening to this, those rules apply. If you are creating content for employees, those rules 100% still apply.
They always have done, and they always will do. It's really that simple.
In researching for this conversation, I came across your business breakthrough days, and they just sounded absolutely amazing. And then I got my business hat on for a moment, because I think, again, as internal comms practitioners, as Rachel Miller would say, it's our business to know our business. When you look at businesses wanting to overcome some hurdle or obstacle, is there often a common issue that's holding them back? You must have seen so many different issues over the years. Do they often boil down to one or two things?
Yeah, it does. It really does. And the first thing I think is that a lot of entrepreneurs are quite type A individuals. And because of that, their number one issue, the biggest mistake, is that they try and do it all themselves. They don't delegate. And the people that I see grow and scale and go further, faster in their business growth will always have a team around them. And a team doesn't need to be a massive, huge team with people spread out all around the world. It could end up like that. But even if you've just got two or three people helping you day to day, or even if you just want to, say, be doing six figures a year, £100,000 in turnover a year, you can totally do that as a personal brand entrepreneur with just one employee. Hire yourself a virtual assistant that can manage your calendar, manage your social media, book your flights, your trains, your accommodation, and make sure that you're as productive as possible every day. And you can easily do six figures, easily. If somebody says, oh, that's impossible, I don't believe that, they're actually kidding themselves. Spend 6 months being mentored by me and I'll get you to six figures if you put the work in. No doubt in my mind about it, because I've done it hundreds and hundreds of times. And so I think that's the first thing, is that they ultimately don't delegate. And because of that, they become the bottleneck in their business.
Yes.
And that bottleneck is a term that's used for a very specific reason, is that things get stuck halfway going down and you can't get anything else into the bowl at the bottom. And because of that, obviously, they can't grow. And that's a big problem, is becoming that bottleneck. The other big thing that I see people doing is not diversifying their revenue streams. So they have one thing that works really well, let's say one-on-one consulting, for example. That's not scalable.
No.
That's not scalable. There's only so many hours in the day that you can consult with individuals and companies. And so the only way you can make more money as a one-on-one consultant is to charge more. And that will work to a certain degree. You can jack your prices up several times over the course of 2-3 years of operation if you want to. But eventually, you will hit a ceiling for your industry where people say, oh, that's too expensive. That's mad. No, I'm not going to pay that kind of money. And at that point, you're not going to grow any further. You will plateau. And the chances are you probably will start losing people as well as clients. And so what I teach all my clients is the importance of diversifying their revenue streams. So yes, if you enjoy doing one-on-one, let's carry on doing it. But A, let's charge what's reasonable and what's doable for everybody involved. But let's cut that right back to, say, 30% of your time.
Yeah.
The rest of the time, you're building up group offers. You're going from one-to-one to one-to-many with everything that you do. So you're creating group programs and offers. you are developing more digital products where, yes, you might have to work hard to create that product, but once it's created, you can automate those sales and the marketing of that product and hopefully turn it into a passive income revenue. Write a book. Every expert should have a book with their name on the front cover. It's the easiest expert positioning strategy that there is. The reason why not everybody does it is because it's bloody hard to write a book, right? Yeah. And so, but if you can push yourself out of your comfort zone and be a little vulnerable and work your way through that challenging part of writing the book, once that book comes out, it'll create more opportunities for you to consult at higher levels, more opportunities to speak, more opportunities to sell product and offers and services. And everybody that works with me ends up publishing a book at some point. It's a non-negotiable.
No, it makes perfect sense. You mentioned the word vulnerable there, and it just sparks another question in my mind about how much of your personal self you give away. What is appropriate? Brené Brown has made vulnerability very popular, but can we share too much?
There's never a really clear answer for this one, because what you're comfortable sharing from a personal perspective is going to be different to me. It's going to be different to somebody else listening to this. I do feel, though, in today's world, we do have to be relatively careful with not necessarily how much we share, but what we share in that context. So, for example, I have been teaching an art class at my daughter's school recently. I'm somewhat of a frustrated watercolor artist. And so their art teacher got taken ill for a prolonged period of time. And my daughter just absolutely loves her art. And I know many of her classmates do. And I stepped up and said, look, I can do it. I'll pop in once a week and help out and teach the kids a few things. And so I shared the fact that I was doing that, but I would never show the name of my daughter's school.
No.
Right? I would never show any distinguishing logos or marks or location information in that regards. And I only posted one photo with any of the children in it. And all of the other kids' faces that were in that photo, other than myself and my daughter, had little smiling emojis covering their faces because they're not my children, right? Mm. And that's me being very conscious of what it is I'm sharing in the moment. Likewise, if I'm going to shoot an external video outside on my property somewhere here in Cambridgeshire, I'm not going to show somebody my front door.
No.
So, I think you've got to be relatively smart with what it is that you're sharing in terms of both from a security perspective, as well as obviously from a personal perspective. I know many people that have children that never share their children's faces online, ever. Yeah. Personally, I'm okay doing it, but I don't overdo it. It might be one out of 20 posts you might see a shot of one of my kids online. And almost always when I do that, it's almost always a story. So it doesn't live on the internet forever. It's there and it's there one day and gone the next kind of thing.
Yeah,
but I think it's a personal thing. It's a personal thing. One of my clients many years ago went through a battle with cancer and he decided to do it personally.
Right.
He didn't share it online, whereas many people do share something like that because it can help them to deal with the current situation and it can also help other people become inspired and motivated to get themselves checked out and all that kind of stuff. We're seeing it right now with His Majesty the King, right? And with Princess Kate as well. It's important for it to remain personal, but understand that for people to truly connect with you, you've got to show a certain amount of yourself. Because people do want to do business with other people. And it's called a personal brand for a reason.
There's a person behind it. Curiosity has got the better of me, Chris. Going back to your art group, has that taught you anything?
Yes, not to underestimate a classroom of six-year-olds.
Yes, that's what I'm thinking.
It was an interesting situation, actually. I love children. I've always loved being around kids. I used to teach basketball many years ago to what they would call a peewee age group, anything under teenagers. I've always loved kids. I've got four kids of my own. Like I said, I'm a big kid at heart. And so it's pretty easy for me to hang out with kids at birthday parties and all that kind of thing. And honestly, there's something about being able to get kids thinking about something specifically that really inspires me. And as a result of this art class, I've actually started writing my first children's book.
Oh, fantastic.
Well, that I want to write and illustrate myself. So it was a very humbling experience to know that I'm actually having a bit of an influence on these kids at a very early stage in their life, even if it was for just a few weeks.
You mentioned a children's book there, but am I right in thinking there's a third business book in
yes,
the offering?
Tell
us about it, if you're allowed to tell us about it. I don't know.
Yeah, I can. I'm not gonna let you know what the title is or anything yet, because that's, believe it or not, finalized yet with the publisher. So I had this idea for this book probably about 3 years ago now. And it was initially going to be very strictly based around relationships in business. But as we've been going through the writing process, my team and I, my writing team, it's actually morphed into something a lot bigger, something a lot more impactful, I think. And it's now going to be aimed towards a very specific type of leader, and not just business owners, but any kind of leadership role. And going more towards kind of like the midlife type of avatar. And somebody that truly has already achieved a certain amount of success, and they want to go from where they are now to where they want to get, but going from success to significance and what that means. And more importantly, what that means over the long term. So there's a certain amount of kind of personal sustainability put in place, and what it means to go the distance, so to speak, in work and in life. And I think, and I know a lot of people talk about their books when they're writing their books or when they're trying to promote their books, and they might say something similar, but I actually think that this is probably likely to be the most important piece of work that I do in my career, because we broach the subject of burnout. We broach the subject of having that longer mindset towards the work that we do, the impact that we have for the people that we serve, the people that we come into contact with. Yes, relationships are still part of the book, but I think there's something bigger at play here now, and I'm actually chomping at the bit to finish it and get it out. But I'm not really in control of that. My publisher will decide when it comes out, but it's likely to be end of spring next year, I think.
I might be making this up, but is this about somebody who gets to a certain midpoint in their career, or just over the midpoint, and starts to think, I might actually quite like a legacy here?
Yes.
Okay.
That one chapter. The final chapter of the book, which actually was the first chapter that I wrote, is about leaving a legacy.
Right. Okay.
So, yes, I've reverse engineered the entire manuscript based on the fact that is the last part of the book. Yeah.
So I have another question for you about that. Because we are going to be living more of our lives working, because we all can see that. People either don't want to retire, or they're going to need to retire later. Although you're saying this is for people at a midpoint in their career, we talked in the beginning about burnout. Do you think there's a need for people to start at the beginning to think about pace, to think about legacy, to think about sustainability in terms of their career? Would that be fair?
Is there a need? Yes. Will it happen? Highly unlikely.
Oh, really?
Because I think when you're younger, you think you're pretty indestructible. I remember what I was like in my 20s and right the way through, probably realistically to my mid 30s or so. You pull the all-nighter. You don't worry so much about jet lag. I didn't think about supplementation and diets and yoga when I was in my late 20s. It's a non-negotiable for me now to have a monthly chiropractic adjustment, and has been for about 8 years.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
Because I know how important it is for the way that I show up and my energy levels.
Yeah.
But I think that self-realization, that self-awareness doesn't come to you until a little later on in life.
Yeah.
But I think the more we talk about it, the more the younger generation out there, God, I'm sounding very old all of a sudden, but I think I am 50. I'm the big 5-0 now. I can start talking like this, But I think, I know, right? I think that the younger folks out there that might be tuning into this might actually be saying, you know what? You're right. I haven't really thought that much about it, but the fact that you're telling me I probably should possibly might force me into doing so. Yeah. And I think it's important for, you know, us middle agers to start talking about this a little bit more. And that's where the vulnerability comes into play. Because when I talk about burning out, when I talk about invasive spine surgery, when I talk about depression and anxiety and all the things that I went through, it comes from a place of genuineness that I think that, you know, some people might talk about that and you kind of sniff it, you know, it's BS. When I show my x-rays and they can see the hardware in my lower back, then it becomes pretty obvious that I'm not spinning a yarn, doesn't it?
I show a similar MRI scan of where my spinal cord is being crushed by this lump that was on my thoracic spine.
Yes.
You can't.
Yeah, I like to call it, the way I describe that is that, yes, as you can look up here on my MRI, you'll see that my L5S1 disc is macheting its way through my sciatic nerve, you know.
Nice.
Yeah. And that's how it felt,
No, I'm with you all the way on this.
Yeah.
This might be a very unfair question to ask, but I'm going to ask it anyway and see where it leads. There are going to be a lot of people listening to this show who are responsible for guiding and advising leaders in terms of how they show up, how they communicate to others, et cetera, et cetera. If you are responsible for supporting, guiding, advising a leader, knowing everything you know, how do I help that person if that's my part of my job? What should I be saying? What should I be doing?
The doing is more important than the saying. The doing is more important than the saying because you have to lead by example. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're just a hypocrite in my mind. And I mean, the people that we lead, they're watching, man. They see everything.
Mm-hmm.
They see everything. And I think we often don't realize that, maybe because we are kind of focused on ourselves. And there's nothing wrong with being selfish like that. That's fine. Even in a role of leadership, you have to be selfish to a certain degree. Mm. But the people that we are leading, the people that we are supposed to be educating and inspiring, they are watching us and they are listening to us. And as leaders, we need to be very aware of that. And we should not ever take the opportunity that we have to lead people for granted. We have to take that seriously.
Yeah. One question before we jump to those quick fire questions, because I know we don't have long. You clearly get a lot done. You're clearly very driven. You have to be inspiring to so many people in so many different ways. What inspires you?
Yeah, it's exhausting. It's exhausting. I need a holiday. Come to think of it. What inspires me? I think there's probably a few things. I think first things first, it's my kids. They inspire me. Because I know they are watching me and they are listening to me. My eldest daughter, Chloe, she's just about to turn 26. She's been working with the company straight out of university 5 years now. And she has, at the beginning of this year, she was promoted to our COO for our Youpreneur brand. And she inspires me. And seeing her build her career, yes, okay, on the coattails of daddy a little bit, but she's taken it and she's running with it. And I am so very proud of her and what she does. My oldest son is running his own media videography business. And my other two kids are at school and doing great. They inspire the heck out of me. Mm. My wife inspires the heck out of me. How she juggles continuing to support me and help me run our group of businesses, as well as wrangle the kids together regularly. And my clients inspire me. Mm. There's a theme here, right? It's the people that I surround myself with.
Yeah.
My peers inspire me. One of my friends is a guy called Ali Abdal. He's based in London and he's just had a Sunday Times book, Feel Good Productivity, a very big YouTube channel. Sunday Times, New York Times bestselling book. He's 28, 29 years old. He could be my kid. And he inspires the heck out of me. He's in a mastermind with me, a peer-led mastermind with a few other different people as well. And so the overall message here is that I am inspired by the people that I spend the most time with. And I think that should be the way you live your life. It's tough to not be inspired if you look at it like that.
And there is that line, isn't there, about we are the average of the total five people we spend most time with or something like that. You've probably heard that.
Yes.
So that sort of falls into that. This episode of the Internal Comms podcast is brought to you by my very own Friday update. Would you like a short email from me, never more than 5 bullet points long, giving you my take on the week's news from across the world of communications? This might be the latest reports, books, podcasts, conferences, campaigns that have caught my eye during the week. I always limit myself to just 5 nuggets of news so you can read it in record time, but still feel a little bit more informed, hopefully a little uplifted as you end your week. Now, this is subscriber-only content, which was initially intended just for AB colleagues and clients. I don't post this content anywhere else, so you do need to sign up, but that is super easy. Simply go to abcom.co.uk/Friday. We just need your email address. And it's equally easy to unsubscribe at any time. So give it a go. That sign up page again, abcom.co.uk/Friday. And if you do choose to be a subscriber, I very much look forward to being in touch. I'm conscious of time. I'm just going to ask you 2 quick fire questions to cut to the chase.
You can ask me. Go on, ask me as many as you want. Go on.
What trait or characteristic do you possess that above all others has most led to your career success?
The ability to bring like-minded people together.
Ah.
Yeah, my masterminds, my live events, my coaching programs, everything I've done has always been, that's the highest level of impact that you can have as a leader, is bringing other people together, I believe. Yeah.
And what is that, though? Is that being able to see in others that they have a common issue, cause, characteristic, and knowing that if you bring them together in the right way and create the right environment, they will feed off each other and just blossom and grow?
That's exactly what it is. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And knowing full well that you're going to be the one that they remember that started it all off.
Yeah, interesting.
And that's huge, because they'll never talk badly about you in that case, you know?
Yeah, I love that. How would you complete this statement? A world-class personal brand is...
Blimey. World-class personal brand is as unique as the person that it surrounds.
Yes. Yes, lovely.
Yeah, we really want to lean into our uniqueness. Actually, I keynoted an event a couple of weeks ago at the NEC in Birmingham, and one of the person came up to me after, and they said, this is a very crowded niche. It was the accounting space. Very crowded niche. There's a lot of people that have been in it for as long as I have, if not longer. How do I position myself to be seen as somebody who's better than everybody else and stand out? And I said, that's the problem right there. You're trying to be better than your competitors. What you need to do is shift that mindset and start figuring out what it is that you do that makes you different to your competitors. How can you be different? Because being different is better than being better.
Yes.
Always.
Yes. Yes.
Always. And he was standing right there next to me, and he's got these beautifully bright red framed glasses. We're talking like fuchsia, bright lipstick red glasses, this guy, and a bald head. And I said to him, have you ever thought about using your head and your red glasses in your branding and in your messaging? And he was like, no, never. And I said, go away and start thinking about that.
Absolutely.
There's about 1,000 people here, and no one else here has got as shiny as a head, you know, surrounded by those beautiful red glasses as you do. Utilize something like that.
Finally, Chris, this is what we do for every podcast guest. We give them a billboard for millions to see, and you can put on that billboard any message you like. We do sometimes mock them up as well, so this could become real.
Okay.
What message would you like?
Where will I see the billboard? That's the most important thing. Mocking up doesn't work for me. I need bloody results. I want to be in the middle of Leicester Square. You might be able to get a deal.
Maybe.
Oh, dear.
Oh, maybe. Yeah.
So what would I put on a billboard?
What's
is that what you're saying?
Message?
What message? Oh, this is an easy one for me. So it is something that I've been quoted on over and over again for probably a decade now. It came out as an ad lib on stage in Las Vegas when I was keynoting a conference over there years ago. And it was at the end of my speech. And I don't know why, but it popped into my head and it just stayed there. And now it's been like a stable part of my focus. And if you've read the book, Rise of the Youpreneur, you would have seen it in there. And it is, charge what you're worth and don't apologize.
I love that.
That fits on a billboard really well,
yeah,
I think,
yeah,
as well.
But a lot of people come to me and say, oh, I don't know if I can charge that amount. I'm only doing one day or half an hour. You're not. You're doing 35 years and one day, because that is what someone's buying. They're buying a lot of experience for that 1 hour. So charge appropriately.
Yeah. And we know, we've got a mutual friend, somebody that you know, I won't say her name now, but she's also in my roundtable group. And when she started working with me, she was charging, we'll say, X. She's now charging Y, and she has quadrupled her daily rate.
Wow.
Since we've started working with each other, and she literally can't keep up with her bookings. She's making four times as much money as she was before, and that's not because the market has changed or anything like that at all. It's not because she's become more relevant, because she's not necessarily. It's because she wasn't charging what she was worth originally, and now she is.
Yes. Thank you so much for your time. This has been an absolute inspiration. So, yes, thank you.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So that is a wrap for this episode of the Internal Comms podcast. For the show notes and a transcript of our conversation, head over to our website. That's abcom.co.uk. You will also find there our entire back catalogue of nearly 100 episodes. If you did enjoy this episode, I have one small favour to ask in return. Please could you help your fellow comms colleagues find our show? The simplest way to do this is to give us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, or subscribe to the show on your favourite podcast platform. My thanks to Chris, our producer John Phillips, sound engineer Stuart Rolls, and content manager Maddie Bruce. And last, but definitely not least, my heartfelt thanks to you for tuning in, and especially to those of you who share your favourite episodes on LinkedIn and Twitter, and who reach out to me directly to say how much you enjoy the show. Your feedback means the world to me, and I do try to respond to every comment. So, until we meet again, lovely listeners, stay safe and well, and remember, it's what's inside that counts.